This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. After growing up in America and getting a degree in architecture, our guest today became interested in green building, but quickly discovered there were few master's-level degree programs in the United States that concentrated on that area of building, so she turned her attention overseas. She took her postgraduate studies in sustainable and energy-efficient building at Oxford School of Architecture in England. In the course of her studies, she visited places throughout the United Kingdom that convinced her that they were 10 years ahead of the United States in the area of sustainable architecture, not just in the course of her studies, but also in the course of her working life that followed those studies. Well, now, Elena Michelle is home and determined to help America catch up, and she joins us for the hour. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
Really?
Yes.
England? Really? We're behind England?
I'm afraid we are. There are many aspects at which America's ahead of them, but this is one of them where we fall behind.
Well, I ask because I've been to England once or twice, but it just seems to me that everything there is so old. How could they possibly be behind us in greening their architecture?
Well, they certainly are attached to their older way of life or their older buildings. Nevertheless, England, like many other countries, have signed the Kyoto Agreement and therefore making them required to move forward with their carbon cutting. They are attached to the EU, as you well know, and because of that, they have sort of a big brother system. They're required to reduce their carbon by X number of percent, and that impacts all facets of sustainability through their lives, either in consumerism, either in home building, in their legislations, and pretty much everywhere.
What kind of a burden does that put on the citizens of England? If it's something even as simple as going to the grocery store or the hardware store, or they wanted to build a new home, or they want to upfit an older home, what kind of a burden does that put on them? Do they view it as a burden? I'm sorry.
Oh, that's quite right. I was going to say that I don't think most people you'll find do view that as a burden. It is so integrated within the culture itself because England has the ability to access the rest of Europe. You have more of a community feel with different countries, whereas we don't necessarily feel that in the United States. But to get back to your question, it is so much in the fabric of the culture that people don't really think about it.
Why is it in the fabric of the culture? It seems to me that their culture is much older than our culture and therefore stuck in its ways, stayed.
You would think that there's many aspects of that. Let me give you an example. If you were, for example, Mike, to go to the grocery store, you would bring your own bag automatically without even thinking about it. The threat of not taking your own bag to the grocery store means that you're going to get stared down by some very nice cashier lady who will give you quite a nasty glare. So you have, yes, very much the aspect of this is Britain, this is the way we behave, but if you don't bring a bag,
how long has that been going on?
Well, that's been going on more steadily for 5 years, I would say. The bags have been available for 10, but they've started taking the plastic bags. You know, we have those really fancy rotating bags at Walmart and places like that. They've taken the bags away. Now you're forced to either bring a bag or ask graciously for the lady to give you a glare and give you one from behind the counter.
Well, now, you know, since you lived there for a while and got used to this, I have five, count them, grocery bags in my trunk. And that's where they live. That's where they stay, even when I'm in the grocery store, because I keep forgetting that I have them.
Well, I'm very...
So how do you remember?
It is all about habit. Why do you leave the house with your keys? you have to remember your keys.
That's a darn fine point.
It's very much about habit.
So when we talk about what's driving the British to the to this cutting edge, at least to us, the cutting edge of being green in the way they live their lives and in the architecture and things, is it just the Kyoto Treaty? Is it just that it's suddenly in their DNA because of their interaction with the EU? Is it energy prices? Is it some kind of a heightened awareness that they've bought into because of energy prices? Or is it a sense of responsibility to the planet that we don't yet seem to have on a large scale?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head. It is all of those things in addition to building regulations and legislations. So they've implemented these laws, these purposes, these goals that have to be met. And if they're not met, then your house doesn't get built, your new building doesn't get built. You've got to meet or exceed these benchmarks. Otherwise, it simply will not happen.
Now, in America, when you start talking about laws and regulations, people really get upset at the prospect of it. How do the English deal with this? Why are they not? I know their system of government is different, and the Magna Carta is not the same as the Constitution,
yes.
etc. But nonetheless, do they look at these regulations from government as being onerous or as being infecting free market capitalism? How do they view this?
In most of my dealings, people are very accepting of it, and they're happy to hop on board. Of course, you're always going to have the occasional client who is very upset about it, and I simply remind them that we allow for fire regulations to happen. We allow for access regulations to happen for people in wheelchairs. Sustainability is just a different type of legislation.
But isn't it true that their culture is not as free as ours, even though we're distant cousins? It's not as free as ours, and it is more socialistic than ours.
I would say that that is true. I don't feel that that should impact, or it does impact, the way that people view sustainability. Like I've said before, it is integrated so much into their very culture.
Mm-hmm.
Any type of system, government system, social system, can benefit from sustainability, even if it's just a means of saving money, and they certainly do that.
Well, not only are we 10 years, in your opinion, behind the British in all of this, that's not the worst of it. You say that Japan, Sweden, Germany are 15 to 20 years ahead of us.
They are.
In what ways?
Well, let me give you an example that's a little bit gross.
okay.
You'll be a bit shocked, I'm sure. The Swedish, for example, have designed a community heating system whereby they actually use people's number twos.
Uh-huh.
I hope I don't have to spell out what
that is. Well, no, I know what that is, but are they using the solid waste, or are they using the gas, the off-gassing from it?
They use the solid waste to create a gas.
Because we had William McDonough on this program, who wrote a book called Cradle to Cradle a couple of weeks ago, and he's heavily involved in helping the Chinese turn vast swaths of farmland into the cities that they need to house their population. But they have to maintain the farmland because they've got to eat.
That's right.
And so they're putting the farmland on top of the buildings that he's building, and they're using the waste products of the animals to generate methane gas, which they then use to cook with.
It's very exciting, isn't it?
Well, I suppose, depending on your point of view, yes.
I guess.
So, but they're doing this in Sweden with human waste?
They're doing this with human waste.
And there's
waste.
No pushback? What's the effect of it? I mean, it obviously works. It obviously is not damaging to your health, question mark?
No, it's not damaging to your health at all. It is, like you pointed out, they do it in China, only it's with animal waste. One of the differences is, of course, is that they're doing this in areas that are already built up.
Mm-hmm.
So to bring in animal waste and create a gas out of it is a bit more cumbersome. Might as well use the resource you're producing in the area.
Is doing something like this something that has to be done on a large scale, or could you, as an architect, design a personal building or a business building that would incorporate that technology in an affordable way, or is that something that really needs to be done on a massive scale with lots of testing and lots of experts controlling it so it doesn't get out of hand?
Well, first, I should point out that I'm not an architect yet. Someday,
okay,
when I grow up, maybe. And then secondly, yes, of course you can. If you're building, let's say, for example, a major housing development, incorporating a community heating tight scheme is the way to go, because you're starting from the ground up. However, if you're building a one-off building, there's what's called microgeneration, and you can create energy right there, localized, or heat perhaps, right there, localized to that building. There's always a solution because there's so many technologies to choose from. But it's not just technologies, Mike. It's also securing that envelope, making sure that it's thermally comfortable. That's the first step in green building anyhow.
You pointed out that you're not an architect, although
yes,
you did all this architecture stuff in school, but you are,
yes,
a green designer and consultant, and you've worked with the architectural firms in helping their clients accomplish what we're talking about this
Absolutely.
Morning.
I am in architecture.
Now, we get back to the Kyoto Treaty, because we've passed up, I think, two opportunities to sign this in this country. It does require the signees to reduce their carbon usage and therefore their carbon footprint. We're on our own because we haven't signed this. So whether we do this, reduce our carbon footprint or not, is completely up to us. Will that work, or do we need to be signatories to something like the Kyoto Treaty to make us do it?
I don't think it is working for us at the moment. We are the only first world country in the world that hasn't signed this agreement. We are perceived by the rest of the world, others who have signed the Kyoto Agreement and beyond, that we're behind and that we're not on board. Being a global competitor has been a big part of making this country great. We're not sending a good message to the rest of the world that we can continue to stay on top and be the number one economy, so to speak, or, you know, king country of the world or whatnot.
But could we be the number one economy in the world if we signed this agreement and did what followed the rules, essentially, of this agreement?
Absolutely. I don't see
it
why
doesn't,
not.
It doesn't impact business. It doesn't impact there must be a cost associated with it. It must be punitive in some way.
It always costs something to get started with anything, but in a world where we're suffering fuel poverty, it will reduce costs in the long term. Mm-hmm. In order for us to stay corporately, large corporate competitive, mm-hmm. we have to be more sustainable.
Well, if signing something like Kyoto is the mm-hmm. stick, get on board or else, what is the carrot?
I don't think I understand that.
Well,
I
mean, if people do view this in this country as punitive, and that's why
okay.
we haven't
oh, pardon
we
me.
Haven't we haven't signed it. Mm-hmm. So if we signed it, what are the benefits?
Well, the benefit is that you can begin to catch up with the rest of the world. Catching up with the rest of the world, of course, means that
but we're
you
America.
Have the environment.
We're America. Why do we care? I'm just playing devil's advocate here.
You're doing a good job. Naturally, we care because it will all fall apart for America. It sounds quite
well,
horrible,
we are,
doesn't it?
We are one of the world's largest consumers of energy, and
we are.
And we're not very cognizant of our impact on the environment, I suppose, because we're so far. We have these vast oceans that separate us from the rest of the world. But you're telling me that because we're becoming increasingly interconnected, and China is on the cutting edge of this, they've adopted cradle to cradle as their government policy, by the way, and the state of California is on the verge of adopting this kind of a philosophy, which will force probably the rest of the country to move in that direction. But because we have the EU and China, two big economies, working on this, we have to get on board, because if we don't, what happens?
If we don't, we will fall behind the rest of the world.
Fall behind in what?
Well, I don't want to compare us to Rome, but Rome didn't last forever either. You know, one must be very careful that your country continues to be on the cutting edge. We beat the space race. Now let's get up to speed with sustainability. Mm-hmm. There's no reason why we can't do it. We have the minds. We have the technology. And more importantly, America's one of the richest countries in the very world. It is an absolute necessity. You'll find that global corporations like Bank of America, for example, have adopted huge sustainability policies to stay competitive with the rest of the global market. Mm-hmm. It's about changing the frames of mind of people who live and work more locally and rather than at a global scale.
Were these regulations that govern what people in England can and cannot do, were they in place prior to the Kyoto Treaty, or did most of them go into place as a result of their signing the Kyoto Treaty?
In England itself, it was after. They had started to develop what is called the Part L building regulations. I'm speaking specifically in building. Mm-hmm. Around the time of the Kyoto Agreement, but it was never in effect until about 2006. So that is about the point that it became a requirement.
We have to take a break. Elena Mitchell is our guest. She's a green designer and consultant, has her own studio here, Second Eden Studio, but spent a considerable amount of time in England, and that's why we're talking about England and the comparison here. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is made possible in part today by the Environmental Defense Fund, using science and economics to meet North Carolina's growing demand for water. Healthy rivers and streams support a strong economy. Finding the ways that work. Details at edf.org. Individuals are taking more active roles in politics, and in some cases, it's starting at a much younger age. For instance, Girls Rock the House. We're going to meet an eighth grader who participated in this nationwide effort to introduce young women to the workings of government, and they worked in areas where congressional districts were represented by women. So Sue Myrick will be here along with the eighth grader who participated in all this tomorrow. We'll talk about that, and then we'll meet several local participants in the Tea Party movement and get a closer look at the issues they deem as critical to the nation's future. That's all tomorrow morning at 9 on Charlotte Talks.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the military takes steps to improve care for soldiers with traumatic brain injuries, PTSD, and other complex psychological problems. The challenges of treating mental wounds among those returning from Iraq and Afghanistan.
That's the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks, here on listener-funded 90.7 FM WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Elena Michelle is our guest. I mispronounced her name going into the break. I'll say it correctly coming out of the break. Elena Michelle, green designer and consultant with Second Eden Studio here, and spent a lot of time in England, 5 years or so in England, both studying and working for architectural firms as a consultant on green design. We're just talking about the Kyoto Treaty, which went into effect in England in 2006. And before that, things were different. And after that, they had to do things differently because the treaty demands that certain things take place to reduce carbon footprints. How much of a transition was it for them? How, for the people, for builders, for business people, for ordinary people? Was it a big transition? Was it something they went, oh, gosh, now we have to do it differently? Or did they just accept it and go on?
Well, I'm embarrassed to admit this, but I was graduating high school in 1997. So I couldn't actually give you quite the comparison, except really what I've found in the past 10 years or so. And then, of course, having moved to England 5 years ago. As a result of the Kyoto Agreement, it, like I said before, it is really so integrated in the culture. I'm not sure what the transition was like initially, but I can definitely tell you that the end result is positive.
Well, when you work with the clients over there, people who were doing things because they had to, how much does it add to the cost of what you want to do when you upfit an older building or when you design a new building from the ground up to comply with the rules and regulations of that treaty and probably other rules and regulations that Great Britain has put into effect on its own? What does it add to the cost? And what would the reaction be here, do you think, if suddenly we adopted the same set of regulations?
Well, it certainly depends on the type of building. There's lots of different types of buildings. If you have a developer, for example, they could put in a community heating system of sorts if they're building 100 plus houses that actually benefits them if they have tenants, for example. And they get money back by putting energy into the grid. However, there are going to be overhead costs. With the regulations, they slowly creep up and they start to become more and more of a carbon reduction through the years. We started out with our clients having to spend an average of 10 to 15% more, and then it slowly creeps up from there. Because it's a requirement, people tend not to challenge it.
It's just built in.
Simply, yes.
So if we were to, what do we do here that we couldn't do? Or vice versa, what would we have to do that we don't do?
Well, We have Energy Star ratings and we have LEED certification. The first step in the building industry would be to make them requirements. That is the best way to catch up to England. Nevertheless, because we have localized governments and localized regulations, it's become a requirement, or your requirements are based upon what happens more regionally rather than on a national level.
Mm-hmm. So, I'm just trying to get a feel for what would have to happen here. If suddenly we were under the demands of the Kyoto Treaty or had some of these other rules and regulations, would we notice the difference immediately? How would Americans react to it? Because you've gone away and come back. You have a double focus here. So how would we react to it?
Well, it's hard to guess that, to be honest with you. I think that you'd have a lot of positive impact or reactions, but you'd have a lot of negative ones as well, especially in the current economic climate. Spending more money is not appealing to people. Nevertheless, you don't always have to spend more money to be more sustainable. There are methodologies one could use already in existing building industries that wouldn't cost you much more at all. It's about having that knowledge. Therefore, it is best to sort of educate the public on that, rather than focusing so much on what you're spending.
The company that you work for in Britain started a second company, a sustainability consulting company, and then you went out and started one yourself as a sideline. But you say you wanted to come home because you saw how much America was struggling to get a grip on going green. alliterative, but what does it mean?
Okay. Well, I began to become quite envious of all these green ideas that were floating about, especially with President Obama being elected and put into office. A lot of people are throwing around the word green and sustainability, and I began to feel homesick on a personal level, but also I wanted to be a part of it. I had seen and I'd benefited England and my clients and a more local level, but I've really felt like it was my patriotic duty to come home and contribute, and Charlotte is a really great place to do that, as we're number 20 in the country for sustainable cities.
That's a good thing?
Absolutely.
Okay, because we're the 18th largest city in America, and we're number 20 in sustainability. And we just had several buildings go up in the last 5 years here in the city, that in the downtown area, that were built to be green or to be energy efficient. Imagine On being one of them, the new Bank of America tower that just went up, the glass building is another, and there are several others as well. Who's ahead of us?
Well, Chicago.
Really?
Yes. They are ahead.
Well, it's cold up there. They have to be energy efficient or they'll go broke.
That's absolutely right.
In what way are they ahead of us?
Well, Chicago, like any major metropolis, they have a lot of built-up areas, especially in the downtown. About 10 years ago, the mayor had decided that they ought to have a green roof on City Hall. Mm. So they went ahead and they put a green roof up there, and it inspired the rest of the city. They went ahead and they had a solar manufacturing plant put right there in the downtown, or in the Chicago area,
right.
Chicagoland area, excuse me, so that the city itself could not only increase employment but also utilize these solar panels. They started a campaign where "Do you want a tree?" was a simple ad that they put in the newspaper, and people could call a government number and say, "My building doesn't have a tree in front of it. Would you mind putting a tree there?"
Really?
They absolutely did.
Something as simple as that. Although that's expensive over time. All right, I want to find out some more about Charlotte, but let's take a phone call, 704-926-WFAE or 800-603-WFAE or wfae.org/charlotte-talks are ways to reach us. Let's go to Josh. I think it's on line two. Josh, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you very much. I just think it's partly the people of our country as well as the leadership that are really holding us back, and I think it's actually despicable that we're so far behind. I mean, every president since Nixon has said that we need energy independence and get off foreign oil, and it just seems like every time there's a crisis, like the spill in the Gulf or Hurricane Katrina or, you know, anything like that, you know, everybody freaks out about it, and they, you know, think about electric cars and green building and everything, and then everybody just kind of goes back to life as usual. And I mean, we really need to do things now to get caught up with the rest of the world.
And usually, and Josh makes an interesting point, usually when we have a crisis, either high gasoline prices in the summertime or a problem with heating oil in the wintertime, most of the time our attention is fixated on, well, we got to do something about those cars. We got to get more cars off the road. We got to get people riding bicycles and mass transit. We got to get people into electric cars or hybrids or something. Is that the solution? Because America is built on roads. It's not built on mass transit. It's not built on railroads. It's built on automobiles. And that's going to, it took 100+ years to build that system. It's going to take 100+ years to unbuild that system, if ever. So is the answer not focusing necessarily only on cars, but in the kind of things we're talking about this morning?
Well, I really appreciate Josh's points, and thank you for calling, Josh. I agree with quite a lot of them, and yes, we can't get upset with future automobiles. There are the hybrids, of course, we can use. It does come down to the individuals like Josh and like myself who say, okay, I'm going to drive a hybrid, and I'm going to take public transportation wherever possible. Here in Charlotte, we, of course, have the metro that's going up and expanding itself outward.
Slowly.
Slowly, but, you know, we're getting
there.
Not
in your lifetime.
Okay. Well, I hope to be around long enough.
But. Okay.
So, yeah, Josh does have a very good point. But
well, when you point to when people point to Europe, they point to these vast networks of trains and subways and mass transportation that really do work, and they are efficient, and they are convenient, because if you want to go from downtown Paris to downtown London, you could probably do it without ever setting foot in a car.
Oh, you absolutely can.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And fairly effortless and relatively affordable. But when you get out into the countryside, if you go to the countryside of France, if you go to the countryside of England, don't they rely on cars?
Well, they do, but you'll actually find that trains do go to smaller cities in the country as well, little pit stops along the way.
But to get to go buy your groceries, to go to the millinery shop, to go buy your meat, etc., you're not going to get on a train if you live in a little village in the countryside of England, are you?
Actually, you'd be surprised. A lot of villages have their own local shops.
Well, yes. So they walk?
Oh, absolutely. But they walk, they bike. Some people do drive. It depends on how far out in the country you are and how remote you are. Mm-hmm. Most of England lives pretty well on top of itself. So going to your store by foot is quite easy to do.
But getting back to what Josh talked about, with mm-hmm. since Richard Nixon, we've been talking about periodically, we need to get off foreign oil. We need to change our ways. And most recently with Obama saying that we need to cut the ties on foreign oil. Is the easiest, most efficacious way to do this to adopt building policies as opposed to automobile policy? I know you have to do a little of both, but is the quickest, least painful way to do the building side of it versus the car side of it in America?
I feel it is, yes. We're constantly building in this country. Of course, we're constantly driving as well. But the way that we live, the way that we work within a building itself has a huge impact on our daily lives. That's a great place to start. I might be biased, of course. Yeah. But
you say that because you've done a lot. We've done a lot of programs on this topic over the years, and other media outlets have written and done programs on this topic as well. But you say that education is one of the steps to move us in the direction that you feel that we need to go in. So are we making headway?
We could be doing better. Especially in Charlotte. There is a fantastic nonprofit organization called Journey Towards Sustainability that is trying to get a bus together that drives from elementary school to elementary school teaching about sustainability. So that's an example of educating on the outside. However, that's not within the curriculum itself, so we could certainly do better.
Do they teach it in England in schools? Do they talk about it in schools?
Absolutely, they do. My son's 11 years old, or he will be 11 years old. At his school, and like many others, they had their own vegetable garden, and the children ate the vegetables that they grew themselves. They went on sustainable-type field trips. They talked to the children about the energy-efficient light bulbs that they put in their classrooms. It is integrated in the curriculum and the culture.
Now, the energy-efficient light bulbs, we have them in this studio. They're running right now. But I'm told, because these are these not incandescent, these little fluorescent squiggly lights.
Yes.
Which are cooler. They don't use as much electricity. They last longer. They're a little more expensive, but you can also get them free from Duke Power. But when it comes time to dispose of them, you can't just throw them in the trash because they have mercury in them and other heavy metals. So are we really doing the planet a favor by using this technology? Should we wait till some other better, like lead technology, becomes more better for lighting and better for the planet? Should we wait?
Well, eventually it will get better. It's always going to get better because we strive towards improvements in the future. But yes, we should use them. It'll save us 80% of the electricity that a traditional tungsten bulb will use. So
then we're polluting the planet with mercury when we throw them away. So are we really being helpful? If you want to look at the whole green aspect of it, it may save energy, it may save money on energy. Is it going to cost us money on something else down the road, and is it going to pollute the planet more than we're already hurting it?
Well, no, because you're using less product. Your light bulb will last you 5 to 7 years, whereas the tungsten will last you 6 months to a year. There should be a telephone number on the back of the box that tells you how to best dispose of the
tungsten
light bulb.
I get back to this light bulb thing, because the incandescent lamp that we've been using since Thomas Edison is glass. That's it. A little piece of metal on the bottom, glass. You can dispose of it. It doesn't really hurt the environment.
Yes, it uses more energy.
Well, yes, it does.
You have to consider the entire embodied energy of the product itself. If I need seven of those light bulbs instead of just the one energy-efficient light bulb over a seven-year period, then I have to consider how that was manufactured, what the embodied energy was to get to the store, how it gets to my house, and the number of times I have to go to and from the store in order to get that bulb.
Are there other aspects of things that go in buildings, because that's what you do, that are similar to that comparison that you just made, that if we shifted our focus from one material to another, it would be better.
Absolutely. We should consider where our materials come from. Locally sourced materials are always the best way to go possible.
Because?
For example, if I wanted to put a hardwood floor into my house, mm-hmm. I would have a look at that and I would say, okay, I could take this beautiful rainforest hardwood floor that came from South America, or I can get some really lovely Georgian wood, which I know has been grown and has transported itself much closer to my house.
Or if you could afford it, you could recycle wood from an old building.
Absolutely, you can.
Or what about bamboo? Because bamboo flooring is becoming popular because bamboo is ubiquitous in parts of the world and it grows quickly and it's, recyclable in a way, but it doesn't necessarily grow natively all over America, so it has to be transported. Is that one of the things you're talking about? Not just the rainforest wood because it hurts the rainforest, but because it comes from South America and there's a transportation fuel cost in that. Is that also what we should consider?
Well, absolutely, you have to consider that. That's what is called the embodied energy. I have some qualms with bamboo because it is grown so very far away from where we live. Yes, it's fantastic and it's wonderful. If we could find a way to grow that locally in more tropical areas of America,
it grows in my neighborhood, by the way.
Oh, so. That's wonderful. So. Are you going to be making some flooring soon?
No, I don't think so. And it's prolific, by the way. Once it starts growing, it's growing.
Absolutely.
A couple of comments here from Facebook. Vaughn writes, England has a smaller population with a vastly different mindset. The scars of 19th century industrial revolution still affect the landscape. I don't believe most Americans would tolerate such a dramatic increase in the government intervention and taxes. And that was kind of the point I was getting at earlier today. What's your feeling on that?
Well, I don't think it necessarily have to assume that it'll impact taxes. But yes, England does have a smaller population. That does make things easier.
But taxes is one way they do it, isn't it? The reason the gasoline or petrol is what? How much is it? $5 a liter? $5, $6? What is it?
It's about $4.50, yes.
Okay, and a liter's not quite a gallon. So it's about $5 a gallon over there. And much of that is taxes, isn't it?
Quite a big chunk of it is taxes,
so yes. That's how they discourage... Is the government trying to make money on the gasoline, or are they trying to discourage the use of it?
They're trying to compensate for the cost of bringing it in. That's how expensive it is.
I have two letters for you. BP. British Petroleum. Don't they have a lot of rigs in the North Sea?
Well, they sure do, but it you have to consider the embodied
energy. Wait a minute. We bring it in from all over the world. We have a cost.
We do, but we also sell it to other countries quite a lot, and they take the cost.
But why does the government have to concern itself with the cost of bringing it in? Why doesn't the consumer have to consider themselves with the cost of bringing it in? The government is artificially inflating the price of it in England by taxing it so high, aren't they?
Of course they
are. And so they're doing that for a reason. Are they doing it simply to encourage conservation or to make money on the product?
They don't make as much money as you think they do. No, it is genuinely an embodied energy issue. Other countries pick up the tab for America.
Okay. We're coming right back. Elena Michelle is our guest. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. And Charlotte Talks is made possible in part today by the U.S. National Whitewater Center, Whitewater River Jam, a summer concert series every Thursday and Saturday night. Live music, food, and drinks open to the public. usnwc.org/riverjam. Coming up next on the Diane Rehm Show, treating soldiers with brain injury. The military takes steps to improve care for soldiers with traumatic brain injury, PTSD, and other complex psychological problems. The challenges of treating mental wounds among those returning from Iraq and Afghanistan will be talked about in about 20 minutes on the Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join our conversation, hop on the phone. 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE. And every other way you can think of at WFAE.org/Charlotte Talk. Sorry, you can't do Pony Express that way, but few people do that these days. We're coming right back.
Getting the latest news headlines is never really a problem. The real challenge, though, is finding out what's behind those headlines. And that's why you listen to Morning Edition. I'm Scott Graff. Join me weekday mornings for the context and perspective that give meaning to the day's headlines. Wake up to Morning Edition from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Elena Michel, who is a green designer and consultant. She has a business here in town called Second Eden Studio, but she spent many years studying and also working in Great Britain, and that's why we're concentrating on this England versus America situation. She says they're 10 years ahead of us. Germany, Japan, Sweden are 15 to 20 years ahead of us on being sustainable and considering green. And it's part of that is due to the Kyoto Treaty. Other parts of it are due to just practicality of the situation in those countries. And one of the terms that you've been bandying about here is embodied energy. We've done enough shows on this that I think I know what that is, and so I haven't asked for a definition, but I'm going to ask for a definition for those who may not know what it is.
Well, sure. It is the cradle to grave or cradle to cradle timeline, we'll say, for lack of a better word, that we put on a product itself. So let's say, for example, you've got a sheet of paper there in front of you. I have to take into consideration where that sheet of paper started out. Did it start out as a tree? And if it did, how long did it take that tree to grow? Then that tree was processed, cut down and processed, and it was made into paper. And then I recycle that product.
It was transported to the paper store.
Absolutely.
It was transported from the paper store to my office.
And then you recycled it.
Okay.
Hopefully you recycled it, Mike.
Right, we do.
And then it becomes paper again or becomes something else. And you estimate the energy, you estimate the carbon, and you estimate the time it took for that product to get to you. And that's its embodied energy. The longer an embodied, or the more efficient, we'll say, an embodied energy is, the more sustainable it is.
Okay. Let's take a couple of phone calls, and then we'll continue our part of the conversation. We'll begin with Carlos, who's on line two. Welcome. Well, it's a question about light bulbs, I believe. Welcome to the program, Carlos.
Carlisle, I think.
Oh, Carlisle. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I'm frustrated with us, the Americans, compared to the British, I mean, or Europeans in general, because just like you were saying about the mercury and the light bulbs, just think of all the mercury that's not being pumped into the atmosphere from burning of coal by using that light bulb.
Okay.
So there are a lot of different, I mean, I think it all boils down to incentives, and so far Americans have not had the right incentives to change their behaviors. We like the status quo, we've liked it for years, and every president since Nixon has been talking about our addiction to oil, and yet nothing has happened yet. And I think that the incentives have to change, and what if we did away with income tax and just had a carbon tax, people might have better incentives to be more efficient.
I agree with your point of view. Incentives are a big key in the UK to motivate people to use renewables and so forth.
But the incentives aren't just sticks like taxes and fees. It's also rewards, isn't it? Like if you do something that's good, you are subsidized in some way. We have some of that going on here.
Yeah.
If you want to go solar, if you want to contribute back to the grid, if you want to buy Energy Star appliances, occasionally we get these little rewards, a kickback.
We do. And that's fantastic and wonderful that we're beginning to do that, especially with Energy Star appliances getting some tax back for that. In the UK recently, they've gone as far as to say not only will we buy your energy from you. Let's say we have photovoltaic panels on my house. Mm-hmm. I produce extra electricity. I put that electricity into the grid. Mm-hmm. Not only am I going to get paid for that, they're going to pay me a bonus for it as well now.
Where does that bonus money come from? Is it tax dollars?
I couldn't honestly say for certain, but I imagine it probably comes directly from the energy company.
Okay,
because
so it's not coming from the government. It's coming from the energy company.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, that's where the carbon tax could really benefit, because the people that put the solar panel on their house would be getting tax credits, whereas somebody who's polluting would be paying a tax. And therefore, it would balance out. And it would also promote more people doing more efficient activities. I just think that would be, the carrot stick. It's not so much sticks. It's about carrots. It's about incentivizing behavior that is more efficient.
Mm-hmm. They do have carbon trading. You're relatively speaking broadly about carbon trading. That isn't for the individual homeowners. But yes, you're absolutely right. People are vastly motivated or corporations, I should say, are vastly motivated to reduce their carbon. Otherwise, they've got to pay for it.
Let's go to – thank you for your call, Carlisle. I appreciate it. Let's go to line one. Shannon, you're on WFAE.
Hi, Mike. Hi, Elena.
Hello.
This is Shannon. Most of being Charlotte, a local nonprofit focused on sustainability. And the point I wanted to add was there's, I think a lot of your comments and questions, Mike, have reflected the general American view that, you know, sustainability is somehow an environmental issue that threatens business or threatens profitability. And I think that's one thing that makes the American viewpoint a bit different in the sense that I think in a lot of countries they recognize that sustainability is as much an economic issue as an environmental issue. And as a result, there's a lot of opportunities for profitability and cost savings. And just to give you one example, with regard to green building, a lot of the companies that do build green, and the reason it's really taken off in Charlotte is there's a lot of cost savings built into those designs. So you can look at the initial construction cost of a building. That's the short-term view. But the long-term view is there's operating costs involved with any building. So you've got the cost of buying energy over the life of the building, the cost of buying water and other resources. So to the extent that the need for those resources can be minimized, you're building in cost savings that will have a return on the initial investment of green building. And that sort of thinking, that longer-term thinking, can be applied across many fields, you know, in addition to green building. And that's where we need to go as Americans in recognizing the long-term benefits as well as the maybe initial higher upfront costs.
That's a fantastic comment, Shannon, and I'm very familiar with Sustain Charlotte. You're absolutely right, and that was a great summary of how a green designer like myself goes about designing. We have to think about our envelope, making sure that it's airtight, thinking about the materials that we use. There are lots of fantastic opportunities to reduce money as well in the construction process.
You sent us some information. You used as an example of a great idea of reusing materials the so-called Big Dig house in Boston. The Big Dig is where they put that big trench in for traffic.
Yes.
And it took them forever to build this, and they were way over budget. But they have built a house using, and you can go to the website, to a website and see this on the web. It's called, I think it's called Big Dig House. You just type it into Google.
Mm-hmm.
And they've used pieces of the old highway and bridges and struts and other things to build this house, which is gorgeous. Is that something we should be doing or could do on a large scale, reuse big pieces of old buildings and old infrastructure?
Oh, absolutely we can. This house is, like you've said, is absolutely fantastic. One of the engineers was in a meeting, in a large-scale meeting, and he stood up and said, what are we going to do with these pieces of the existing motorway or highway?
Mm-hmm.
They said, we don't know. And he said, well, can I have a couple pieces? And he approached some architects, and they built a house. As a result of that, those architects, and you'll have to visit the website, their names escape my mind, and it shouldn't, they have built sort of terraced housing, or what we call townhouses, for more fragments of the highway. These opportunities are all around us as America continues to build and rebuild.
Mm-hmm.
But also in a fantastic place like Charlotte, we have some existing buildings that are reminiscent of our past that could be restored or renovated and use those as a sustainable opportunity as well.
Let's go to Carol. She's on line six. Carol is actually going to, I hope, hammer home the point. This doesn't all have to be done by government or industry. Welcome.
Hi. First off, I want to say I really think it's wonderful that you're having this program. I think more discussion needs to be done on environmental sustainability. But I just wanted to mention that you know, there's some inexpensive things that we do at home, and you know, I'd love to have a solar cell, but that's way out of our price range. But what we've done at our house, we have a 3,000 square foot house. And pretty much every window has an old-fashioned shade that's made out of light blocking material. So in the summertime, you know, and especially, you know, the last couple of weeks, the shades are down. Now the house is dark in the inside, but it's also cool and it's comfortable. And I just got our electric bill. It was $85.
That is fantastic to hear. Yes, it certainly starts with individuals, and I think that's more prevalent with these conversations we've been having this morning with Mike and the other speakers or the other telephone callers who've been calling in. Everyone who calls, I'm really pleased and glad, says that they want to go in this direction, that they're pleased for that. So the fact that we haven't got a lot of opposition.
Well, you're on NPR. You're on NPR. If you were on another station today, you might be getting a different reaction from people. That's why I'm asking a lot of devil's advocate questions about business and taxes and things like that, because that's what a lot of people think.
Well, it's going to start with the individuals. Right. If we don't feel like our government is doing what it's supposed to, it is our duty as Americans to make that happen. And Karen is a great example of starting at her home. We can all start at our home.
It would be wonderful if you could, you know, tell us more things that we could do that are inexpensive things, you know, that would help save energy.
I do that for quite a few clients where they simply want me to come into their house and we just have a walk around and we go through a checklist and we have a chat about it. So feel free to visit my website and contact me.
So tell me, give me a few. If I walk through my house, what should I be looking at?
Well, it's hard to say. I haven't been to your house. Every house is different and special. Something you're going to definitely want to look at is your windows and your doors and mm-hmm. how well that they're sealed, how old they are. Knowing the age of your house helps us to guess and determine what.
But if you have leaky windows and doors, and that's certainly where a lot of energy escapes, both winter and summer, if you have that, let me tell you, I have a lot of windows. If I had to replace all those windows, I'd go bankrupt. So what are my alternatives if I can't afford to replace them?
You don't always have to replace your windows. Of course not. You can do what Karen's done and put on solar shades, which are external. Mm-hmm. You can buy what's called more energy-efficient window fittings or treatments, which maybe are a bit thicker for winter. You could go about sealing it. You stop by your local sort of Home Depot.
Buy some caulk.
Buy some caulk. Mm-hmm. And go ahead and seal up your windows. If you stop by your local hardware store and you ask them questions, they'll point you in the right direction to the right products. So you can absolutely use the existing windows you've got.
But aside from that, you have heating and cooling expenses. You have water usage expenses, water heating and water usage expenses, and electrical expenses for lighting.
Can I mention something about the water heater?
Sure.
Okay, well, this is another thing that I do. I'm just such a cheapskate. My water heater is in the garage, and when I'm going to do, you know, things around, you know, in the house, you know, like washing dishes, washing laundry, things like that, I turn up the water heater, but otherwise I turn it down. I turn it down to where it says low. And then, you know, my family knows, you know, if they're going to take a shower, you know, to turn up the water heater, and but then after that, it goes back down. So our water heater doesn't, you know, it's not on as much.
Well, it sure sounds like you are saving your family a lot of money, so you should be very pleased with yourself about that. It is simply a shame that that your water heater wasn't designed to sort of compensate for itself or to think smart for itself. There's what's called smart meters that you can install, and you can program that meter to be aware of approximately the times where you might be using more hot water.
So in other words, if you know everybody in the family is going to be taking showers between 6 and 8 o'clock in the morning, at about 5:30, the water heater would start heating the temperature properly. And then at 8:30, it would simply go back down to where she sets it normally.
Absolutely. It's called a smart meter.
So it's like the smart thermostats that people are installing, and that's a smart thing to do, too. I would take it, right?
I quite agree, yes. It's a very smart thing.
Thank you for your call, Carol. I appreciate it. Some email comments. Maureen asks, do you have advice for people who want to go into sustainability as a profession? Is there a program in the United States? And one of the reasons you went to England was because you wanted to get a degree in this, and you couldn't find one that was, at least when you started. Maybe there are programs now.
Well, there's a fantastic program right here in Charlotte. It's called the Center for Sustainability at CPCC. Hmm. They have a wonderful program. You could focus on one of four different types of sustainability fields, and it's a two-year associate degree. So you can absolutely get a degree like that. However, if you want to go into an architecture type degree, UNCC right here in Charlotte has a fantastic program for sustainability as well.
Okay. Shepherd writes, so I agree with most of what Elena says, but I do not think it's a good idea to cultivate bamboo in the United States. Bamboo is an exotic species which escapes cultivation, invading local ecosystems and squeezing out local populations of native species. And that's why I said it's in my neighborhood, and it grows.
It sure does.
Everywhere. I look through a presentation that you put together showing us some of the things happening in Britain, including at the consumer level, and you made a point of mentioning Marks and Spencer. Now, they're not Walmart. Well, but because the other designer we had on here, William McDonald, said that as Walmart goes, so goes the world, and Walmart has adopted his cradle-to-cradle philosophy. So that means that it's going to spread through the consumer ecosystem because of Walmart. But Marks & Spencer has 900-some stores scattered throughout their region of influence, and they sell everything from furniture to clothing to specialized food. So they're kind of like an upscale Walmart.
They are definitely a posher version of Walmart,
okay.
Yes.
So they print, as I understand this, the carbon footprint of the products you're buying on the packages of food. Has that had an impact?
Absolutely. Most stores are doing it now.
Really?
Absolutely.
What
are.
Does it say?
Very common. Well, it will give you your carbon in kilograms, and that is the, to use the word we were playing with before, embodied energy of that product, what it took to get to you. And it tells you exactly what the carbon kilogram is.
So just like reading the nutritional information and putting it back on the shelf because there's too many fat grams or too much sodium, you put it back on the shelf because the carbon footprint is too high?
You could do, yes.
And I would think that's the whole point, isn't it? I mean, to encourage that behavior, and then Marks & Spencer would stop selling it because you're not buying it.
Absolutely.
Which changes the way things are made and delivered.
It sure does, and it impacts other stores to be competitive with Marks & Spencer's.
Elena Michelle is a green designer and consultant. She has a company here in Charlotte that helps people to achieve this in their own lives. It's called Second Eden Studio. After spending many years in Britain studying and then helping those people cope with their onerous laws. I'm just kidding. Thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome.